This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
All right, welcome. Here we go. Closing arguments just wrapped up in the Lindsey Clancy case. What happens next? What could be the possible outcomes for Lindsey Clancy? We are going to break all of that down in great detail today. We got a great panel to do exactly that. Lindsey Clancy's jury has sat through 21 days of testimony, 84 witnesses, closing arguments. They have just taken place. And now that they've ended, 12 people have to decide whether a mother who admits to killing her three children goes to prison or goes to a psychiatric hospital. Eric Fatt is defense attorney, former prosecutor. Joining myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program, and master class extraordinaire. Can I say
nice
that
ad.
One?
Yes, yes, you can. Yeah, we are live with our master class.
Okay, and link is in the description. Robin has a master class now, which is freaking amazing. Go and check that out. Okay, Eric, let's begin with this. Nobody in this case is arguing about what happened. The children are dead. Clancy admits she did it. The only question the jury has to answer now is whether she was criminally responsible when she did the act. So what does that task now actually look like inside this courtroom with these jurors, more importantly, in the jurors' deliberation room, now that the instructions have been given, and it's up to them to decipher whether or not she was there. She was mentally with it. She could tell right from wrong. Again, there's so many caveats, because every time I say one of these things, it breaks it down. Well, what does right from wrong mean in that stage? What's your best way of describing it here?
Sure. So, Tony, in these cases, during closing arguments, I'll usually give the jury some recommendations in terms of how to go about their job back in that deliberation room. So in this case, part of that job is going to be determining, has the prosecution proven beyond a reasonable doubt that she could appreciate the wrongfulness of her conduct? And so essentially new right from wrong. And also whether she could conform her actions to the law. And so you can kind of go about that in a stepwise fashion. And really the question for the jury, Tony, is whether there's a reasonable doubt as to whether she's criminally responsible. It's not, you know, did the defense prove that she is not criminally responsible? Because that's not their burden. Is there a reasonable doubt? Is there a lingering question that is significant in the juror's mind as to whether she is criminally responsible in terms of being able to know right from wrong and conform her behavior to the law? That is the overarching inquiry.
You know, given how complex this case has been, I mean, in all honesty, I've probably learned more covering this case than any case we've covered in the last 4 years with Tony, because there's so many different things we had to learn about. I mean, we're watching Reddington, who admitted, you know, outside the courtroom as well, you know, what he had to learn about postpartum psychosis, postpartum depression, women's health, the medical system. I mean, we're all covering this so closely that it's been a massive education on a lot of sides and seeing failures on others. With all this complexity and the lawyers trying to break it down to be consumable by these really heroic jurors that have to have the hardest decision now, what do you think is the hardest instruction, if you could guess, for them to follow on this? Because there's going to be many of them, or maybe there's not. Maybe it's pretty simple. I just don't know.
You know, there's a central instruction, Robin, that's given in every case of which I'm aware that's criminal. And that is that the jurors cannot let sympathy or prejudice influence their deliberations. So that's the thing. This is a heart-wrenching case. It is so evocative. That's why, in part, it's gotten so much attention. But the jurors have to, you know, do they have to turn off their hearts? It depends on how you interpret that instruction. But to try to have some sort of cold, calculated legal analysis about this case without emotions playing into it one way or the other, emotions for three dead children and emotions for a mother who was clearly suffering, those things should not enter into the deliberations. We'll see if the jury can do that.
Which is the hardest thing to do, because, I mean, wrapping your head around it, I mean, you got to have a tiebreaker, because each of the, both the prosecution and defense mental health experts that came up there are basically saying all exactly the same thing. She had a very, very, very broken brain. And it's that split, whether it's criminal responsibility or not. And it's a coin toss according to which psych you're talking to. And then if you're left with, well, the data is divided, what am I left with to break that tie? It's what I gut feel about it, which is an emotion. It's really tough. So when you're faced with that, Eric, how do you advise someone that has that tie internally when they don't know which way to go?
I think you say that they have to follow the law. These are the jury instructions here. We don't expect y'all to be robots, but we also don't expect y'all to have any sort of sympathy or contempt or any sort of those right. feelings. Weigh on that calculus that you have to balance for making a determination.
The lesser charge of manslaughter has been introduced here. And I listened to the jury instructions this morning too. I've watched many jury instructions. I know you've seen them far more than I have, but I mean, they're long, they're, you know, just lingering on and on of, okay, but then on this, you got to look at it this way. My mind's spinning by the time it's done. I can only imagine theirs is spinning by the time it's done. I kind of think I understand how they work. But at the end of the day, it's going to come down to appreciating the wrongfulness of her conduct. And then you add the manslaughter in there as a possible outcome, as a lesser charge. Does that confuse the jury? Help us as the non-weighing jury, the general public jury that has their opinion on this.
Armchair
help,
jury.
Help us understand for the armchair jury, Eric, what the manslaughter charge could possibly mean, what the jury would have to accept for them to render that as their verdict here versus not guilty by reason of insanity, essentially.
You know, what we're talking about just shows how difficult the juror's role can be. So look, the jury could decide on the top count of murder that, we're not saying she is lacking criminal responsibility, but we don't think there was an intent to kill, or we don't think there was premeditation, or however the jury comes out on that. That doesn't mean that Lindsay Clancy's off the hook. There's this lesser included of manslaughter where if the jury says, hey, we don't know about premeditation. We don't know that she was thinking about this for a long time and planning it, but maybe she did it. And we're not so jazzed about the lack of criminal responsibility. This lesser included charge provides the jury sort of a compromise verdict if they were to go that route, whereby they would determine that Lindsay Clancy either knowingly or with gross criminal negligence or recklessly caused the deaths of these children. There are less elements for the prosecution to prove on that. It's a lower burden in that sense. And that I think it's more likely that they would come, if they come to a guilty verdict, I think manslaughter is more likely. And then lastly, the lack of criminal responsibility piece, if the jury goes that route, that takes away all the criminal charges, whether it's murder or manslaughter. So a lot of moving parts.
You know, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Todd.
I want when we're talking about that, and we're talking about, you know, appreciating the wrongfulness of all this on the jury instructions. I mean, there was a lot in there, and I'm just curious to get your opinion on this. Does the language of jury instructions need to be updated to current times? Because in the same realm of having to not let sympathy or prejudice influence your decisions, there's so much language in the jury instructions that are, it's emotional. There's so much in there that is about, and I'm trying to paraphrase, I didn't write it down earlier, but when I was listening, I'm like, that's confusing to me, where it's talking about things being like horrific and disturbing. Those are emotional terms. Those aren't legal terms. So you're asking the jury to weigh things on terms that are emotional to them, but at the same point telling them that sympathy and prejudice can influence their decision. That's literally how some of the instructions kind of go. It's a really look over here, but don't consider this part, but kind of weigh some of this over here, but don't weigh it when you're considering. I mean, what the...
What's your thoughts?
It's sort of like, I don't know if you've seen that meme of Charlie Day from It's Always Sunny, where he's in front of a whiteboard and he has all these things written, all these connections made, and he's, you know, beside himself, bewildered about this task.
Yeah.
That's how I imagine that jury feels back in that room.
Oh,
and some of these instructions, Tony, were written decades and decades ago.
No, I know, it's like witch trial instructions.
Yeah, you know, verbiage has changed. Really, the common meaning of some of these terms has changed.
Yeah.
And on top of that, if you've sat through a jury instruction advisement, it can go for more than an hour with all these unfamiliar terms. How helpful is that really to the jury for them to do their job?
I'd be more confused after it than ever. I was waiting for it to be like, and if you believe, she might be operating a coven out of the back of her house. Like, where did that one? I'm obviously making that one up. I'm sorry, Robin, go ahead.
Yeah, no, all I want to do is listener brought up, and I know we keep focusing on this aspect of it, but at the same time, hands down, you know, I want to make sure we remember the victims' names, Cora, Dawson, and Kaylin, Callan, the, you know, the three lives that were lost at the hands of Lindsay, as we're trying to figure out and understand what inspired her to do it, whether it's criminal responsibility or not. And now going back to that, what I'm still curious about this manslaughter possibility, What do you think inspired the judge to do that, to add that in there? Because I've never, again, you've seen many more than I, obviously, but I haven't seen that in any of the cases we covered where the judge added his own charge. And how common or unusual is that? And that charge, do you think it helped the prosecution, helped the defense, or was he purely putting it in there for the jury's benefit?
In Colorado, where I practice, one side or the other has to request those lessers. Usually, it's the prosecution who asks the judge, hey, we need to add this charge as what's called a lesser included, or defense will say lesser non-included. But at any rate, that, I think, helps the prosecution, because this is such an emotionally charged case. These jurors, the burden that they have, the weight that they must be feeling in terms of the decision they got to make must be immense. And so there are some folks who might in that jury room say, hey, there are three dead kids here. We got to do something about this. Maybe it's not first degree murder, but gosh, shouldn't she have some legal responsibility for this if that's the route they go? And if so, these lesser included, like manslaughter, provide that potential compromise verdict. And so I think it gives the jury another option between, you know, was this the worst crime we can that's on the books, or is she not responsible at all? Maybe there's some middle ground the jury comes to, and maybe that's manslaughter.
Yeah, it's like a relief valve from all the pressure of the one, because you can't. Yeah. Do you think, I'm guessing the attempt was to also lessen the probability of a hung jury?
Yes, I think that you're absolutely right, Robin, that it's going to be difficult for these jurors back there. And if they're like, hey, we can't all agree on the top charge, but maybe we all can live with this other charge, that wouldn't be uncommon.
And one more follow up. Why wouldn't have the prosecution gone with this charge to begin with?
Sometimes you don't want to convey to the jury that you're not confident in your case. And when you add if the prosecution were to add a lesser included like manslaughter, that might tell the jury, hey, we really believe that it's first degree murder, but we don't totally believe that because this other charge might be applicable too. Sometimes they go for broke with the top charge and don't want any lessers.
And it's the defense who actually added it in, who asked the judge, Reddington's the one who wanted that added in there. Yeah.
Even though we think it might benefit the prosecution. I'm sorry, Tony.
Look, it benefit Lindsay too. It puts a middle ground there to get to a conclusion. Grant, I mean, Eric, let me ask you this. When it comes, if she were to be found guilty and it's a manslaughter charge, obviously it is a lesser penalty. But what does that look like for her in terms of, is it an automatic ticket to prison? Does it help her get into a mental health facility rather than a prison? Is that sort of consideration taken into account here? What does it mean other than just, it's likely a lesser sentence of time.
Yeah. That's really the primary function, is that it limits the potential exposure in terms of incarceration for Lindsey Clancy, and it limits it substantially. You know, we're talking first-degree murder is up into life without the possibility of parole. Manslaughter in most jurisdictions is something substantially lower, like depends on the jurisdiction, but could be like 5 to 15 years, something mm-hmm. like that. And with good time, earned time, and other considerations, it could result in a person convicted of that being out, in a relatively manageable number of years, at least considering what she's facing.
What sort of control does the judge have over where Lindsey ends up going at the end of the day? Like, if she is found guilty here, let's say it's not even manslaughter, let's say it is manslaughter, or it's the above charge, the murder one. Does the judge, is she automatically going to a prison, or does the judge have any sort of say of saying, yes, you're going away forever, but it's not to an actual prison, it's going to be back to Tewksbury or the state hospital or something of that nature? Is there any direction there, or is that Bureau of Prisons, or is there really nobody that has a choice? You're found guilty, you're going to prison. And there's no ifs, ands, and buts about it.
Judges really try to stay out of incarceration placement post-conviction, in part because they don't have jurisdiction over these different facilities. They have jurisdiction over the parties. They can say, hey, defendant, I can make you do something. But they can't make some white-collar prison take her if the prison doesn't want to. That's really a determination between in a state court case, it would be the equivalent of the Bureau of Prisons for the state of Massachusetts. They would decide, but it's not going to be some kind of mental health facility. It's going to mm-hmm. be a prison okay. if there is such a conviction. There's no discretion to say, hey, instead of a real prison, we're going to put you in a doctor's office or something.
Yeah, I looked that up a couple of weeks ago at the onset of this, you know, possible sentencings if she was found guilty. And then Siobhan covered a little bit, too, about the process. As I understand it, if she's convicted, she goes to the state prison. She's put in a holding cell, like we saw with Koberger, to be evaluated. And based on that evaluation, a placement inside the prison itself will happen. If she's evaluated to have mental health issues, which she does, she can be placed in a separate mental health unit, but not with nearly the same care. And this is what Siobhan was talking about the other day, but not nearly the same care as she would be if she's staying where she's currently at. As well as the added challenge of this is, because she's still on S-Watch 24/7, that's going to be the immediate thing that they're going to have to accommodate as well, plus being paralyzed from the waist down. So I was researching like how they accommodate that. That's going to be most likely, in many cases, not all, but from what I read, another prisoner that takes care of that aspect of her, which makes her vulnerable. I mean, it's so complicated. It's unbelievable.
I want to ask you about the S-Watch, Eric, because obviously they've needed to keep her alive to get her to trial. I'm curious on the logistics of how that actually functions beyond just we're going to keep her alive because we really want to get her to trial, but we're going to keep her alive because that's like the morally right thing to do because we're not fucking monsters. When this extra weight of, well, there's a trial coming up, let's keep her alive, is gone because the trial is done. Is there the same weight that is put on the S-Watch? How much influence does an attorney, do you as an attorney, have over S-Watch on a client that you're very concerned that may end it because they got nothing to live for, this sort of a case, but we need to keep them alive for trial versus trial's done? There's advocating, but does it change the equation a bit behind bars or in a mental health facility in terms of how well that watch is being done, I guess.
Yeah, you know, in my opinion, the S-Watch in most facilities is, like you said, the objective is to keep them alive. It's not to make them not want to engage in that type of behavior. And so to keep them alive for trial, that's one thing. But after the trial is done, certainly there's an objective to keep them alive. But what care is really being given to sort of reform their mental processes, if possible, and get them better? That's not the objective. It's even less of an objective after trial. And the attorney, the most they can do is make threats. They could if they think that there might be inhumane conditions, they could contact the jail and say, "Hey, if you don't fix this, we're going to sue you for cruel and unusual punishment civilly." And sometimes the jail will make changes. Oftentimes, they'll simply ignore that. And so not a ton of power for the attorney on that either.
And think about this too, because if she's on S watch in a Gen Pop prison, most times that says you're going to be in isolation, which is then throwing kerosene back on the fire, which causes the mental health issues, which is going to make her decline again even more for a higher risk of S. I mean, it's like never ending cyclical cycle of crazy.
Now, how much, let me ask you this, Eric, how much has this been a battle of terminology, and how clear do you think it is to the jurors going back about the words that have been used here? The prosecution's own rebuttal expert, Dr. Avram Mack, told this jury that Clancy was in a severe depressive episode. He wouldn't call it psychosis. Some of the other experts did. Other experts also said bipolar. But the legal standard doesn't say psychosis anywhere. Right. I mean, that's kind of been what we've been talking about here in the ether. But at the end of the day, it's not about psychosis or being in that specific state. It says mental disease or defect, which could be bipolar. Which could be the effects of bipolar, not necessarily being in the psychosis state. Does the jury even need the word psychosis to get there? Do they understand that going in? What's been your experience in that, Lane?
The jury does not need a specific diagnosis like psychosis or anything else in order to find Lizzie Clancy not criminally responsible. They could find that she was emotionally distressed. They could find that she was depressed. So long as there is some mental disease or defect, whatever term you give it, that is going to be enough. And on top of that, you know, the prosecution's been talking about postpartum depression, defense postpartum psychosis. You know, these are all kind of, I guess if I was hearing these over 20 days or something, that they might get jumbled together. And I think it sort of is to the benefit of the defense in the sense that we all agree there was some serious mental health stuff going on. So I think that mental disease or defect piece has already been met, regardless of whether the jury accepts psychosis. Now, the other requirements, that's a different analysis.
Yeah, because it comes down to everyone agrees mental disease, mental health issues, severe. And everyone just keeps arguing criminal responsibility or not.
Well, I think there's a comment here that was just made, and I think this is like the crux of how a lot of people are. I feel like the interpretation is being messed up in people's minds, and that she take responsibility for what she did to her own babies. She has. Mm-hmm. Wait, show me where she hasn't taken
responsibility. She admitted it.
She admitted it. She's taking responsibility. She's asking to be judged by the letter of the law, not by the people with the pitchforks who are angry that are screaming about babies. This is not a woman who hasn't not taken responsibility. She's not sitting there and going, "Patrick did it," like half of the people out there are. She has taken responsibility. I guess, what is that in people's minds, the idea of her taking responsibility? Do you want her to go and say, "I killed them because they were evil children and I wanted to have a different life"? Is that your version of responsibility? Because that's not reality. That's not what she was feeling. That's not what her track record and her history and her documented writings of what's going on in her mind show. Would that make everyone happy if she just spews out a bunch of shit like that that's not even real? Is that taking responsibility? Or is taking responsibility exactly what we've been watching in that courtroom for the last month?
Yeah, I think it's a really insightful point because you know, this isn't a person who was like, I have these mental health issues, but I didn't really do anything about them. I didn't care. They were affecting my behavior. I was starting to do weird stuff and I wasn't even trying to manage that. And then this horrible thing happened and too bad. And I want to move on with my life. That's not at all been the tenor of how she has handled her portion of this.
Yeah.
The responsibility thing. Yeah. She said, "I did it." And then what she wanted to do, now she wants to die. She's not fighting. Reddington's fighting for her, on her behalf, because she is claiming responsibility that I did this horrendous thing and I just want to die.
I don't know how anyone could take more responsibility other than the, like, kill me, which she's already pretty much said she wants to die. I mean, if you gave her the option, I think she probably would have pulled that lever.
And would now. That's why she's
would
on.
Now.
Because as they're showing, as they're demonstrating, even the prosecution psychologists are shocked at how long she's been on S-Watch. 3 years, one-on-one, because it's that severe. And so you have people like Reddington coming in that are true believers in her and the mental health crisis that's going on in Massachusetts, if not all over the place. And you have them champion on her behalf because she has claimed responsibility, as according to all the testimony she fought. And everyone agrees, this isn't Robin's conjecture, in the testimony, she fought hard for help. She didn't get the help she needed. She kept shopping around for more help because it wasn't working. I mean, all these things that we saw throughout this testimony, that is responsibility. And the ultimate responsibility, she doesn't want to live because of it. And so what's going on is others are battling on her behalf for not just her, but the system that needs to be fixed, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of amazing what people will conjure up or the ways things will be twisted. And I don't think it's intentional. I just think it's like we think about these things on certain paths, and this is so far off the norm that it is. We got to kind of like take our shift and go, okay, this is not common. This is not normal. We have to look at it over here with a bit of a different set of rules or a different magnifying glass, because this is not a common situation for many people. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.